What would you do with a massive check? What if somebody handed you $431,613,000? Better yet, what if somebody handed you $814,086,000? Or maybe you might hit it really big, and that payday would be $3,931,200,000. What am I talking about? I'm talking about my personal stock worth and my company, Digital Convergence. It's been 17 years now, and I'm telling the story step by step of the truth behind Digital Convergence and our Q-code technology, and how it was innovated in everything we went through, including the development of our initial device called the QCAT. Now, I want to give you something. I'm going to give you this program in four parts. It's a four-part series. I call it the four B's. What are the four B's? The four B's are the big idea, the boom, the bust, and born again. I'm going to take you on the journey of an idea, from an idea out of nowhere to a billion-dollar company and then losing it all. But more importantly, I'm going to give you $200 million. How am I going to give you that $200 million? I'm going to give you the details of my $200 million education in what not to do. I'm doing this because this is a precursor to my new book coming out, telling the story, not only my biography, but of my professional career and what it's like to be an entrepreneur and inventor way ahead on the cutting edge of technology, but more importantly, to share with you the inside secrets and machinations of what it takes to really become an entrepreneur, what it takes to really launch an idea, and what happens when you become a household name and a pop icon, and everybody watches what you do, not necessarily on the high accolade side, but what happens when you get caught up in a market or technology bust. This is going to be a roller coaster ride. I hope you stay with me all four parts, because all of this is derived from my personal development of the technology that now you see everywhere. You see in every grocery store, almost every ad, and every product in the world. But it was a hard ride and a long ride, and it almost killed me. I'm going to not hold anything back. At times, my mouth may utter a cuss word. And it's not in anger, it's actually in pain, sometimes in shame. But it's to tell the story exactly as it occurred and the truth of what happened. And a lot of the things I reference, you can find out there on the internet if you actually understand the difference between news and blogs. And I'm not talking about bloggers that currently today are in their late 20s or early 30s that happen to be about 6 or 7 or 8 years old when I came up with and introduced my idea, and they're just regurgitating erroneous information. I'm talking about the actual interviews, studies, journals, and articles that were released about our company as we were doing it, starting in the late 90s into the turn right at 2000. So you're going to be hearing facts and information from sources like the Wall Street Journal, the Security and Exchange Commission, NASDAQ, Broadcasting and Cable, Forbes, Newsweek, Bloomberg News, the Washington Post, Times Magazine, Harvard Business Journal, even the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and such pop magazines as People Magazine or newspapers like the Daily Mail, etc. I'm going to give you the hard facts and the real facts about what it takes to launch a product, to make it a household name, to be thrust into the limelight, but more importantly, how to pick yourself back up and continue on your destiny to change the world and make great things happen. Remember, it's far easier to criticize and to jump on a mindless bandwagon of beating people down, but it's ultimately harder to really dig in for and find the truth and to take the lessons that are to be learned. So, in a paraphrase, if you can learn from me and my personal technology Titanic disaster, then you will be better equipped to live your dreams. And unlike this one deal, which was the four B's, the going from the big idea to the boom to the bust and the born again, that I might share with you how to avoid the pitfalls and hit the Control-Alt-Delete on your computer to make sure your big idea just goes to the boom and you might become the next technology billionaire. Part of this is very hard for me. Part of this is very painful. You're going to hear where I ultimately ended up with a 38 in my mouth. I'm willing to share this with you so you understand everything that goes into not only thinking of, creating, ideating, patenting, launching, releasing, and seeing it through to the bitter end of any idea, but also you might expect what happens when you become highly successful, written about all the time in the press, and how people tend to, especially in today's society, they love to attack successful people. If you have what it takes to become an incredible, profitable entrepreneur, then the one lesson you need to know is how to deal with the public backlash. I tell people when I share my story, and I share this in boardrooms, in conferences across the nation all the time, I go back to a time, and I can paint a major motion picture movie for you that gives you a great summation of what it's like to one day be the hero and the next day be the fallen. Let me take you back to Spider-Man when he's fighting the Green Goblin. You know the movie, and I'm just using a movie example so I can get for you a picture in your head. Do you remember when Spider-Man was in the Daily Planet office, and all of a sudden the Green Goblin crashed through the window, captured Spider-Man by spraying that smoky knockout mist on him, and took him up to the rooftops? Now, when Spider-Man woke up, here's the Green Goblin, played by William Dafoe, and the Green Goblin is trying to convince Spider-Man to partner with the Green Goblin. And in that moment in movie history, the Green Goblin utters a most profound business truth. He proceeds to tell Spider-Man that, you know, this city loves its heroes, but there is one thing they love more than their heroes, and that is to see their heroes fail. You see, it's a human condition that people are, unfortunately, and it's more and more happening in this day and age. And if you don't believe me, look at social media. We've become social idiots. We don't do deep research anymore. We only read headlines and taglines and think we know the news. It's easy to criticize. It's easy to call names. It's easy to label. But if you're listening to this, you have what it takes to learn, to dig deep, and to find the truth about anything. And that's what I hope to part with you, because if I can pass to you my $200 million education, think about it, an advanced college degree, you're stuck with a student debt of maybe $200,000. And the world tells you because you have that master's or PhD, you're ready to conquer the world. I'm going to pass to you a $200 million education. Use it the best way you know how, but remember, facts matter. So let's get started in this very first segment, and let's talk about the big idea. How did it all start? Where did it all start? And how did I come up with the idea of Q codes and what we now call scan commerce or scan to connect? You know, the funky little codes that you know when you look at them that you can use your mobile device and scan and retrieve internet information. Well, I had been known in my career for developing the big ideas. I had just come off two early multi-billion dollar direct marketing success. First, most people knew me for triple edge windshield wipers, guaranteed to last as long as you own your car. That particular company I took from bankruptcy to over $518 million in sales in just 2 years. It was a simple story where investors brought me in to look at their product that they were going to liquidate. They bought a bankrupt company with a few patents, had several hundred million dollars worth of inventory, and were asking me, hey, can you help us liquidate this merchandise? Now, I'm not going to tell the whole story here because they stand alone, but I just want to let you know where I was coming from immediately just before I developed the idea that codes can shortcut this thing that was coming called the internet. When they asked me to liquidate the merchandise, I said, give me a few samples, give me everything that's ever been done on it, let me look at it. I took it home, I dived through it, and I realized there was a brilliant idea buried in there. It was just handled wrong. It wasn't triple edge, they were the smear clears, and they didn't have a marketing campaign that delivered on the promises that the product could really do. So that minor tweak and their trust into my track record and their trust in my abilities led to them jumping off with me. And that's where we were able to take something out of the dust of bankruptcy where the bankers bought it, put together a new company, and do $518 million in sales in just the first 2 years. After that, I got recruited for two different projects. One of them was what I would be known for in Washington, D.C., placing me inside a company where back in those days where you saw Mike Levy on Amazing Discoveries and Ian and doing the car waxes and the products and the juicers and the exercisers on TV under the banner of Amazing Discoveries and other products, you never realized it was this young kid behind it finding those products, executing those agreements, coming up with the ideas, and then rolling them out in the other markets. So I had a tremendous run as the executive vice president and executive producer of that series and that public company. Most people knew those products. But, as always, I'm the entrepreneur, not the company man. And when my one assignment ended in Washington, D.C., just after a few years, I went back to my home in Texas and began building my marketing career all over again. And that's where I had just done Susan Powder. You know, the diet lady, diet expert with the shaved white head, telling the world to stop the insanity. That was, again, what I had immediately come off of, and I had to take an unknown housewife, package or create a product around her, get an infomercial done, and get it rolled out to America. Well, from that idea, from zero to creating an idea and product, immediately became a $350 million juggernaut, with $27 million in sales just the first week after we released it. Selling thousands of product every single week. Again, I'll share that story with you in the future in an individual recording talking about how to do those. But this is about the idea of scan to connect. What happened? How did we create it? Yes, it was important to understand and scan and connect that I understood what made people buy, what made people adopt, and what made people agree to do products? I mean, come on, I could go on TV and I could do $3 million or $2.9 million in sales just in 80 minutes, and I could create a pop icon. So after this time, I came off of Susan Powder. I had just done an infomercial for ABC Radio. They were lagging in the Arbitrons. I had to figure out a way to take a top station that had fallen to dead last in the market and get them back to the top of the market. I did it through an infomercial. It was the first time I ever really did a big local infomercial. But we took them right back to the topic in the market. And, you know, you're not going to get a piece of sales of ABC Radio. So what they gave me was a radio show. Now, I was doing two things at the same time. See, in 1993, when this all began, it actually started in 1992. Let me tell you how I got cued on to this thing that eventually became the internet, would become the way the world would operate. See, I'd just come off handling celebrities and packaging them and being an agent. And frankly, I was absolutely disgusted and tired dealing with the egos. You know, it's very hard when you build a pop icon and a multi-hundred-million-dollar company from a housewife, and then you get later into it and you hear things like, I'm a star and you will treat me like a star. That kind of did it for me, because I think people don't remember where they come from. They don't remember who got them there. And unfortunately, they eventually begin to believe their own press. So I basically stopped doing everything and retired to my cattle ranch in Texas. My days were spent pushing cattle. My days were spent managing my ranch. If you saw me then, you saw me in jeans and boots covered with cow shit up to my knees of being in the fields and being on a horse all day. One of the things I tried to do is I tried to always hire local talent to run my ranch, to give kids a chance to learn how to work with their hands and work ethic and mentor them along the way. See, I'd had a great career. So in this local small town where my ranch was, I hired several high schoolers, or those going right into high school and high school, to be my ranch hands. One of these kids turned me on to what was called at the time BBSs, or bulletin boards. Now, I had an idea of how things communicated from two sides. I intimately understood, because of my time in Washington, D.C., the intelligence community and intelligence networks at the government level. And then if you think about the public level, all there really was America Online or CompuServe. I had known the CompuServe guys, and I ironically was in Virginia where AOL started. So I understood the AOL side. And for me, AOL at the time was nothing more than how to get your weather reports or your stock reports, chat or message back and forth, or look for chicks to date. That was AOL for me. And at the time, you were paying by the minute, right? You could have a large bill. It was as a minute by you go. And people started to use this thing, a online network, versus, because there wasn't really technically the internet at that time. Well, this kid taught me about BBSs, and I started looking at BBSs, and I saw how BBSs transcended the typical online AOL and what it did. And I began to understand intimately, and knew it was coming from my work in Washington, D.C., knew it was eventually going to be released to the public. I started to understand how people could really use this network, not from an individual user standpoint, mind you, but from a marketer standpoint, because I understood it's just like sending direct mail. If you can send something to somebody's computer and do a promotion, it's like sending the mail for free. So I got excited about it, and I actually wrote a book and released it in 1993 called The Next Generation. It was kind of a Star Trek themed book about this pending and coming information superhighway. Now, since I did all this work in television, I understood multiple channels breaking up, and nobody believed at the time you'd have hundreds of cable channels to watch. They just couldn't comprehend it. They couldn't understand it. But I knew this was coming. I knew it was going to eventually make it into the public domain and could become something big. So that's when I started fine-tuning my knowledge, because I do deep research. I get immersed in it before I do it. Just like you see me on social media now, have seen me very heavy in social media for the last 8 years. Why is that? Not because I love social media, not because I love the trolls, not because I love the accolades, because I'm doing deep research to understand how it all works so I can invent the new new. So as I dug into it, did this book, did speeches on it, talking about this coming information superhighway, it just happened at that time that the Hunt family in Texas, very well-known wealthy family, gave me a call because they knew of my work, both of Susan Powder and Triple Edge, and says, we're thinking about funding a guy that wants to create a dial-up internet company. And we know you're the guy to make it work. So I sat down and looked at what they wanted to do, three geeks in a room, and they were selling internet, not by the minute like everybody was used to with America Online, but they were selling it $19.95 a month, use the internet all you want. Think about it. That's how we used to get our internet. This was right at that time when the 2800 baud modem had just come out. That was lightning speed. There were no pictures on the internet. The pages were still gray. It was Mozilla. There was no Yahoo. There was not even a Netscape at the time or Internet Explorer at all. But when I looked at it and I understood my own personal experience of paying for the internet by the minute, I knew this would be the future where people would just pay a regular fee a month. And if you could convince them it was worth that regular fee, you could get many people to sign up. So I took the deal. Most of y'all saw what that company became. If you follow my career, it actually became Internet America. And it was known for the tagline, 1-800-BE-A-GEEK. All I did was, once again, prepare infomercial, teaching people what this internet thing was going to be. How did I do it? I shot an infomercial. What was my infomercial? At the time, the hottest thing on television was Friends. Little did I know that the producers and company of Friends would, in short order, become my partner. But we'll get to that. What I did is I took Friends and I cloned it into an infomercial and took a group of hip friends who all had one thing in common, the use of this new thing called the internet, and I created a show how the internet was changing their life. When at a time when people really didn't know or understand what the internet was. Now, at this time in Dallas, Texas, there were about 3,000 and change AOL users in the Dallas marketplace. And that was one of AOL's largest market, of course, outside Washington, D.C. and the Virginia quarters. And all I did was sell against AOL. If AOL, and you stayed on it every minute and paid by the minute and used the internet all you wanted, at that time your monthly bill would be over $2,000 a month. There was a time, just like in our cell phones, when it used to cost us hundreds of dollars a month, sometimes thousands of dollars a month. I can remember $3,000 mobile phone bills before they put it to bite size. Well, there was a time that the internet was the same way. A lot of y'all listening to this, millennials or whatever, you don't have the concept of that's what it used to be. But that's what it used to be. So all I did was sell against AOL and said, look, if you really want to use this internet and here's how it is, why don't you just do it for $19.95 a month and you can consume all you want. And all I did was teach them, here's all the cool things the net can offer you. And here's where it can go. Now, at that time, I got the show done, got it ready, and we just went from 2,800 baud modems, and now where we were, 9,600 baud modems were coming out. That was the blazing speed. That was the new introduction at the time by U.S. Robotics. Very few pictures, really very few things to do on the net, but I sold the world the vision of what the internet would become and that they needed to have it. Well, where AOL had not quite 4,000 users in Dallas, Texas, and I turned on this marketing machine and television and basically put 30,000 people on within the first few weeks. It was a major juggernaut. So now the perfect convergence for me happened is a few things kind of triangulated. I had this radio show because I'd just done an infomercial for the local ABC show, ABC Radio. And I had just done this television show for what was one of the first internet dial-up companies. So now I'm sitting here doing this radio show, and I myself, as a marketer, am breaking all records. And I could get thousands of people to show up at a live event where I would appear, where even the top radio show host in the market were lucky to get a double handful of people to show up. That's because I sell what the vision can be, and I get people excited about it. And a few things triangulated at the right time. Here I am sitting doing talk radio. We're rocking and rolling, and we're talking about the internet. All I did was take internet help and put it into a fun, entertaining format. I already knew what the questions people were struggling with, because over here in our internet dial-up company, I knew the problems were happening. I knew what the current themes and questions were. So since I had all that data and I knew what people were struggling with, I just took those questions, put it in a television show with great geeks to answer my questions. And when I use the term geeks, I mean that affectionately, with all affection. It's not a degrading term. And we basically answered people's tech questions on the air and showed them how to do it. So now, instead of trying to understand it on a phone, now people at home are tuning in and we're teaching them how to use a computer, how to use the internet, how to do dial-up, how to configure it, how to open your email, how to type an email. I mean, it was really basic then. But people loved it because they too knew computers and this internet thing were coming. They knew it was going to happen. And then one day at our radio station, guys walked in and said, "We think people are going to want to listen to radio over the internet, so we want to put in a server." So right out my studio door, not 2 feet on the left, with our engineers, they put in a server, and all of a sudden, now you could listen to our radio show over the internet, and you could listen to the radio station over the internet. Who were those guys? Well, that was Mark Cuban and Todd Wagner. And that was their company in Dallas, right alongside me, called AudioNet. In fact, my very first guest on the air was Mark Cuban. Because here's what we did. See, I had this radio show, and I'd been at that time a guest on many radio shows, and I love talk radio. It's kind of why you hear my cadence today. It's kind of why you hear my ability to talk through this microphone and motivate you. But I was doing radio, and I'm a television guy. I speak through visual images. I visually consume and visually understand. And so I knew what I needed to do is I needed to get a visual form of what I was teaching people. So what we innovated and pioneered at the time, now we're about 1994, I put a series of television cameras in my radio studio, took a closet, literally a closet, put in all the switching and broadcast equipment, and I turned my radio show, which was now had the ability to go over the net and reach any home in the world, into a radio, television, internet show all at the same time. In fact, in the Dallas-Fort Worth marketplace, you could watch me on television. And if you had to run to the store to get something from the store, you would walk outside, get in your car, turn on the radio, and continue with the program. Or if you were on your computer, if you're at work and you couldn't really watch TV, you could tune in on your computer and listen. We created the world's first triplecast. Now, it was not without its difficulties at all. Why? When I first wanted to turn it into television, I went over to ABC. I'd already had a great television career. I told ABC, this internet thing's going to be big and I want to turn it into a television show. Mind you, I'm talking to ABC. ABC, in a few short years, would become one of my major partners. However, I told ABC and this local, large media company that I want to do a show about the internet. And here's what they said. The internet's a fad and it's going to go away. Of course, this television company owned newspapers and everything else, and that was their procrastination. It's gonna go away. The internet's a fad. So I went over to Fox Television. Fox Television, at the time, was just building themselves. They were known for In Living Color. Luckily, because of an innovative station manager and sales manager there, Buzz Saul, the simplicity of the idea, knew it would work, and he said, Jovan, you get me the signal as long as we don't have to touch it. We will throw it up on Fox. You provide us programming. We'll do these splits of commercials. They get X, I get X, and let's go. So we turned it into a triple cast, and boom, we debut our nationwide program. On that night of the debut, I did it at the Dallas West End, where people could come see me and my compadres do our show live. And in just Dallas, Texas, standing out in the cold, it was icy, it was horrible, it was below freezing, we had over 44,000 people. 44,000, that's more than at the time most stadiums could hold, came to watch our little bitty internet show, teaching them how to use the internet. And what we did is we expanded that program all around the globe. Now, that night, too, would change my life because I was high profile, had tremendous amount of media experience. I'm all over television in a local market, and I attracted a stalker. It was during that broadcast that I'm standing on stage, live feeds around the world, 44,000 people in front of me. Right way through the broadcast, a laser dot appears on my forehead. You know, like a sniper shot. Luckily, it occurred when it did, and within seconds, bodyguards there for the broadcast and security whisked me off stage outside where I was live and got me inside the building, broadcasting from inside the building where they could manage the security a little better. That stalker would eventually change my life. We'll talk about it in later episodes. But in all this time, what I'm doing is I'm watching this thing called the internet, how people use the internet, how people use online media. At that time, we were one of the very first websites to get millions of visits every week. Very few even did a few thousand visits a year. So I was learning this working. I was learning how people use it. I was learning what makes the internet tick. And I put in place an idea I came up with in 1992 and 93, understanding, because I dove into it, I understand that the internet actually worked off of numbers, but the way they got the internet to work is getting people to understand words. Here's what I mean. You know Yahoo.com as Yahoo.com or Google.com. By the way, there was no Google then. But really, the way the internet works is there's a number under it, like 123.45.001.2, right? You got a DNS number underneath it. The internet works on numbers. They laid a word over it so you, the consumer, wouldn't have to remember the number. You could remember the word, type it in, add a .com, and you could go there. That was the breakthrough that made the internet work. When the hypertext markup protocol, right, when it linked it all together with words. Well, what I understood as this thing called the internet was being built was that all of us are numbers. You're a number, right? Long before your name or right after you're born and given your name, what do you get? A social security number. You get a driver's license number. You get a street address. You get a cable bill number. We're all numbers. In the systems of the world, we're numbers, not names. And when I realized that every product in the world was the same thing, a bottle of ketchup was a number. What was that number? A barcode. What did the barcode mean? Inventory in, inventory out. $1.99, pay for it. When I realized that everything was driven by codes, then I realized what made the internet work will make people connect easier because I could take every product on the shelf that had a number and I can make that physical product connect to the virtual world. As long as I could show the physical product to a computer somehow. Now, you have to understand these times when I came up with it. You know, we're now only up to the 28.8 modem. No cable modems at all. There was ISDN, but it was wildly expensive. No broadband. None of that. Very few pictures on the internet. But I understood that numbers drew everything, but people can't remember numbers, so make it short. And web addresses were absolutely nuts. We're finally learning to use whatever .com /this/this/this. And the web addresses were absolutely ridiculous. And I understood that television would drive the web. Why did I learn that? Because I was doing a television show. And I could drive people to websites, but it was very hard to get them to the site. So I only drove them to my site and said, look for the link, because we couldn't put the link on TV. It was too damn long. So I tried an experiment. I was in the middle of developing a national television campaign. So I put the very first URL on television in a campaign just to see if it was just hanging on the screen. Now, this is nationwide. If it was hanging on a screen, would people just go there to see what it was? Not say anything, just put it in the show that was running. And lo and behold, hundreds of thousands of people just looking for things to do typed in that web address and went. And therefore, I knew that TV and easy connectivity was the linchpin. Not high-tech stuff, simple stuff. Simple stuff. And so what I then began to perfect was a way that codes could talk to computers and launch them to the websites. This is at a time when there were flip phones. There were no cameras in phones. None. In fact, when you bought a $4,000 or $5,000 computer, right? The brand new models that came out with the D2 math coprocessor and had 100 megs of memory. That was a computer. It's laughable now. But that's what we were dealing with. So I had to figure out a way, how can I make a computer see codes? I knew that people even typing in the numbers of a barcode and our Q codes was still just the same of typing in a web address. How could I shorten it? So I had to figure out how to give the computer eyeballs. Now, see, I knew that cameras and phones were going to be coming in short order. How did I know that? Well, see, my largest sponsor of my television series was Microsoft and Radio Shack. They were the underwriters of my program. We taught Microsoft when they came out with Internet Explorer and we convinced them to come into our television series. We took their market for the browser where Netscape had over 90% share and within 30 days switched it where Internet Explorer had over 90% share and Netscape almost went away. We had already taught them how to market that starting in the Dallas district where we were. And I knew what was coming down the pipe. Remember, I'm always looking forward to see what's happening so I know about what to develop today. And then, of course, with Radio Shack, and Radio Shack at the time being the largest seller of mobile phones in the United States with their 10,000 stores at the time, I knew everything ultimately is going to go mobile, the only way you know it now, and that these things will ultimately come out with cameras. But we still weren't there. I had to find a way to make the computer see the code. So what I did is when we figured out we could make the codes launch a computer, and we used a standard barcode wand. At the time, we had bought it, CompUSA, remember them? And we configured it, and we learned to make the code drive a web address. and you could swipe these codes and it would just load the web page. You wouldn't touch anything. You just swipe it with a barcode and boom, you'd go there. What I did is I basically made a few stops along the way to show people what I was innovating. Now, I'd come up with it in 93. Now I'm getting into late 97. Now I'm going to start showing the vision to elicit the help because now I know I need a device. One of the first places I went was to Radio Shack. The reason I went to Radio Shack is because I traveled around the United States and I met with all the barcode manufacturers in the world, and the cheapest barcode thing that they manufactured at the time, the cheapest, was an item they wanted to charge me $1,700 for. I knew the world would not buy a device for $1,700, and I knew if I was going to jumpstart this Q code phenomenon, where you just scan the code and go, don't even touch it, I knew I had to make something that was free. And so after talking to all the big manufacturing companies about manufacturing my barcode with me at cheap enough that I could give it away, and the cheapest they could come up with was $500 or $600, and they just couldn't see the vision. And remember those guys, they made their money by selling devices. They didn't want to make one cheap enough to give away. So as a last-ditch effort, I went over to Radio Shack, the sponsor of my television program. And what I did was I walked into the boardroom. They set a great meeting for me with all their top executives. And I said, let me show you what I think will happen. And I beseeched them to grab any product in the room of their boardroom and swipe it and watch what happened. I statistically knew what was hanging around, and I brought some products to put on the table as well, like a Coke can or a bag of Doritos. Altoids, you know, mints. They swiped with my little wand, and all of a sudden the computer took off right to the website. The president, soon to become CEO, the president sat there, looked at it, got up, looked at me, walked out of the room. I'm like, holy shit, what just happened? Did I piss him off? Did he not like what I did? And all the other Radio Shack executives and my team from television are sitting there looking at ourselves thinking, what the hell just went wrong? I thought I screwed it up. I thought I just pissed him off and he walked out the room. Almost 20 minutes later, he walks back in. We were just about to pack up and leave. We had no answers. President of Radio Shack walks in, and he walks in with the chairman, CEO of Radio Shack, Lynn Roberts. And here's what he said. Jovan, do nothing, say nothing, sell nothing. Just show Lynn what you just did. I took the device, picked up a product, swiped it, boom, the website popped up on the computer. Lynn looked at me, looked at Dave, grabbed the device himself to see if he could do it, picked up something else in the room and scanned it. And then looked at me and proceeded to tell me this story. He said, in the 1970s, a young kid walked into Radio Shack, Tandy at that time, and said, if you will give me $5 million, I will give you 50% of my company because my company can make your computers sell because my software is what's going to really make the computer work and make the breakthrough. And he said to me in the 70s, in the mid-70s, when that young kid just like you came in and told us that, we weren't interested and we sent him on his merry way because we could not see the vision. And he said, and we're not going to let that happen again. We're not going to miss what this is. He says, because in 1976, when we turned away Bill Gates, we were stupid. They didn't see the vision that eventually became Windows, that became the juggernaut you know as Microsoft. And they said, we're not going to miss this one. This is absolutely brilliant. It's a simple way for people to use computers and go. They said, what do you need from me? I said, I know if anybody in the world can manufacture a device cheap enough to scan codes, you're the company that can do it. I need for you to figure out how to make this so cheap that I can buy 10 million of them and afford it so I can give it away to the public. Here's what Radio Shack said. We can figure it out. We'll put the best team in the world on it. All we want is let's do a deal. When you give them away, they come to Radio Shack to get them free. And I said, done. So my job would be, because I was Mr. TV, all I have to do is teach people on TV how to use my device and say, go to Radio Shack, pick one up for free. Radio Shack's job was to figure out how to make this exceptionally cheap so I could give it away to America. So when all the various manufacturers of scanners and everything else were quoting me prices of $1,700, $1,100, $350 being the cheapest, if I bought a million up front, that's $350 million. I couldn't do it. I couldn't afford it. It was ridiculous. Radio Shack engineered a device that would do it, work phenomenally. They paid all the development costs. Didn't cost me anything. It just cost me a pledge to send people into the store because they knew I could do it. Remember, I had all this marketing background, and they were the sponsor of my television series. They knew I could drive people and motivate people. They did all that. So they came up with a device that was basically about $3 that would do the same thing. Eventually, going forward, which I'll tell you later, they came up with a device that we could do for 26 cents. They were the impetus. So now that I knew I had a device, and now I knew that I had a great manufacturer to manufacture it, one more call occurred. And I'm going to share with you that as we begin this journey through our boom time. So I'm going to set it up for you this way in the conclusion of this segment. One of my people involved in the television show that believed in the vision, and he is the entire reason that our company got done, and he is the linchpin. Yes, my idea. Yes, my patents. Yes, I'd been fostering for 4 and 5 years, and here we are now in the late 90s. I know I'm going to get my device. I've got this billion-dollar company that's going to participate with me. I own all my company. I've run it successfully. I'm profitable. This one fellow who believed in me by the name of Brad Smith, he is the unsung hero. He is why it worked. He is why you have Scan to Connect and Scan Commerce today. He knew the chairman of the Dallas Morning News. So he picked up the phone, because it's all about relationships, and he says, I'll get you a meeting, because he asked me, Jovan, what do you need? And I said, well, now that I've got scanning down and now I can make scanning work, I need to make it work in the shittiest print and the shittiest paper in the world. Let me tell you why I need that. I always know a code can work if it's printed great and printed good. But there was more newspaper print out than High Slick magazine, so I needed to know it worked with the shittiest ink and the shittiest paper. What is that? That's newspaper. Wrinkle. Maybe the dye's not good and solid. So he picked up the phone, and he called the Dallas Morning News, the Belo Corporation, called in a favor to the chairman and said, would you meet this guy? You know him in the market, because I was already well-known in the market. We had a skyrocketing, top-rating TV show that just beat everything in the market. They knew who I was. Now, remember, I want to tell you one thing. Belo is the people that owned ABC. It was Belo that I went to a few years earlier and said, hey, I want to put my television show on your network there because they owned ABC, that the very same executives told me, the internet's a fad, it's going to go away. So I'm walking back into the same offices that I had been in, where I showed them my idea for a television show teaching the net, and I could get in on my own because I had a great reputation and had done all these great things, and their executives look at me and tell me, the internet's a fad, it's going away. Here I sit now in this same boardroom. And sitting in the room is the chairman, an executive, and then Burl Osborne, love him. Burl Osborne is the president of the Dallas Morning News, ends up becoming the chairman executive of the Associated Press, et cetera, et cetera. And I show them my little demo, and I swipe things along the room, and they swipe them themselves, and their eyes light up and go, basically, holy shit, this is going to be big. You just took newspaper, and you made newspaper control the computer. I said, yes, sir. They said, what do you want from us? And I said, I would like for you to take some of my unique codes that I've created, you know, these funky-looking Q codes, and I would like for you to print them on your newspaper printing press. Put a few in the paper. You don't have to tell anybody what they are. Hell, stick them anywhere you want. It doesn't matter. I just need to know, what are the tolerances for scanning so I can make my device read the lowest common denominator print? And yes, I told them it's newspaper because it's the shittiest print on the shittiest paper. That's how I am. I'm direct. They agreed. And they said, we think we can do that. And then Burl, chairman of the Associated Press, said, we'll do it on one condition. Now, remember, I'm only walking in to get them to take a few of my codes, put them into their layout, print them on their press. That's it. Didn't cost them anything to do. I just want them to print it so I can see and teach my devices to read the crappy print. Burl said, there was no ask. Burl said, we will do it. I will approve it only under one consideration. I said, what's that? He says, you allow us to invest in your company. Are you taking investors? And I said, no, sir, I'm not taking investors, but I'll certainly consider it and make a maybe make a space for you. Sure. Let me think about it. I said, what are you thinking about? They said, let us put in $1 million into your company. Give us just a little piece of your company. We'll give you $1 million. I said, yes, sir. I'll think about it. And I left. Now I'm leaving downtown Dallas, not too far from Dealey Plaza, which is where, of course, JFK was shot. And I'm headed up the Dallas Tollway, and my cell phone rings, and it's Dallas Morning News, Belo Corporation, says, we've thought about it. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, they don't want to put in money. No big deal, because I'm not asking them for money. They said, we thought about it, and we need you to let us put in $5 million. Of course, I was floored. I said, well, let me think about it and figure out what it is. And I go back to my office. The next day, when I call Belo to tell them, okay, I'll make room. You can invest in my company, although I'm not looking for an investment. Burl tells me, we've changed our mind. And then he said, you have to let us put in $10 million. And I'm like, holy shit. Okay, we'll figure out how to do this. He says, the only thing we need you to do is to go to New York City and meet with our investment banker just so he knows what we want to do and he can sign off on it. Now, this investment banker had a phenomenal track record, and he was at ING Furman Sells in New York, and I went in, and he is the guy that had just negotiated their acquisition of the Providence Journal. It was a $1 billion acquisition, which, of course, was a major, major acquisition back then. And I walked into the room with the banker at Furman Sells and came in. About lunchtime, the time for our meeting. And I walked into the room, and here's this fellow, Michael Guerin. Incredible reputation as an investment banker. One of the original creators of telepictures, Lorimar telepictures, you know, Dallas Dynasty, Falcon's Crest, all the top shows. And now working as a banker and handling media properties and working in the newspaper field, handling newspapers, specifically Belo. And he says, oh, Jovan, you're here. He says, I'm excited to hear this technology that Belo is talking about. He says, my friend here is coming to have lunch with me. Can he just sit in on the room and see it? And there's this nice looking kind of sandy haired big fellow in the room. And I said, sure, no problem. I'm there for Michael. I'm focusing on Michael. So I proceed to show them my demo, and I proceed to show them my technology. And he basically, truly, just like everybody else, said, holy shit, this is going to be big. You're like connecting the physical world to the virtual world. He says, I'll get with Belo. This is great. How can I help you? See, that's what this is about, leverage and connecting with people. How can I help you? Executives like to help other executives. They like to show their influence. They like to show their skills, their power. And I said, I'm looking for a president to run my company. I need a president to run my company. He says, okay, let me think about it. He basically called Belo, approved the transaction for a $10 million investment. I left. I go back to my hotel. I get a phone call, and it's Michael. And Michael says, I think I have found the president for your new company. See, I needed a great president to run this thing. And I said, who is it? He said, well, remember the guy in the room that was there for my lunch meeting? Well, that's Scott Carlin, and you know, he's the president of Warner Brothers Televisions, and he's Rosie and Friends and all these top shows. He was Mr. TV. He is like Mr. It in Warner Brothers, right? He says, Scott should be your president. Well, that kind of excited me. I'm like, wow. He says, we'll meet with Scott this evening. Y'all have a late evening. Can't do dinner. We'll have late evening, sit down for drinks and talk about it. So Scott showed up at the hotel. We sat there, shared a drink, and I proceeded to pick Scott's brain. Scott picked my brain. And I said to Scott Carlin, Mr. TV, Mr. Juggernaut TV, you're not my president. And he kind of looked at me really weird. And I said, you don't know enough about this thing called the internet. You don't know enough about this thing called technology. You don't, you know television and you know syndication, but hell, you don't even really use email. I knew I needed somebody that's fairly technology savvy, to say the least. And here I am telling the one guy that everybody in the world wants in TV, you're not my president. But we parted ways on good terms. The next morning, I get a call from the banker. He's a little excited. And he says, I hear you told Scott Carlin he's not really qualified to be your president. And I said, yes, sir. I'm sorry, but he doesn't know enough about technology, and I need somebody who really kind of has at least a grip of technology to lead this thing. And he says, I understand that. I said, but I did tell Scott, you know, we're going to have this whole television division. Why don't you just become the president of my television division? And on the spot, he agreed, and Michael confirmed that, and this powerhouse television guy joined my company from Warner Brothers, right? Big executive. And so Michael said to me, well, I have another person who should be your president of your company. And I said, really? He says he's done billion-dollar transactions, got a pretty good grasp of technology, knows this deal is all going to be about relationships and who you know and putting together the right things. And I said, that exactly sounds like the right type of person I need. I said, who is it? He said, me. My jaw dropped. Here is one of the best investment bankers out there. Huge credentials. Just negotiated one of the few billion-plus mergers in media. Just met me yesterday. Could go anywhere he wants in the world. Seeing my technology going, this is going to be huge. Offering me the president of Time Warner Television, or Warner Brothers Television, to become my president. And I said, no, not my president, but he can become president of TV. And he comes, and here's this guy with incredible power saying, I want to do this with you. I said, done. And that is how this began. The one note I want to share with you is we never actually asked for money. The one thing you need to take away from this segment is if you have a good technology, if you have a great idea, it will sell itself. So let me give you my philosophy of sales. Everybody shies away from sales and salesmen and marketing and especially infomercials, and I take a lot of hits for it for being infomercial, and they'll call you late night huckster on TV and all that stuff. That's basically reviews from people that couldn't sell their way out of a wet paper bag. And they think selling is a bad thing. See, I don't think selling is selling. I don't think any great salesman sells. See, I think a great salesman is nothing more than a great teacher. See, I've never sold anybody any of my products. I didn't sell the world $500 million of windshield wipers. I didn't sell the world in excess of $250 million worth of Susan Powder diet programs in just a year and a half's time. What I did is I educated the world what she was doing, who she was, and how it could change your life. It's all an educational process. The person who sells is the person individual buying. They sell themselves. They look at the information, they look at the facts, and they make a buying decision. So selling is not something you do to people. It is something you do for people. And there's a material difference. It's not beating them over the head. It's just showing them the message, showing them the vision. So never think, oh my God, I can't do this because I'm not a salesman. I can't make this happen. I'm not a salesman. Well, neither am I. But if you believe in your product and you believe in your idea and you've got your shit together and you actually know how to tell the story and you know the benefits of it, you understand how this will benefit people, then your only job is to educate people on the benefits and they will sell themselves. I walked into Radio Shack and just showed them, hey, this is what it does. Here you go, look. And it basically means anybody can look up anything instantly and they don't have to touch their computer, remember the web address or how to go deep down in the web. They just swipe. All I did was show them the benefits. When I walked into Belo, I didn't sell them. I just showed them what it did. They understood, oh my God, he just made paper talk to a computer and it came up. Selling is not selling. Selling is educating. And that's the first thing to remember about your idea. Never be terrified thinking, oh my God, I'm not a salesman, I'm a technologist. No. You only have to be one thing, an evangelist. You have to believe in your idea. You have to know how to demonstrate it to people. It's all about the demonstration. If you know your product and you know your people and your product and your idea is rock solid, show it. Ask for the meeting, not, hey, I want to get $10 million from you. That's a crap meeting. You'll never get the meeting. Ask for a meeting. I want to show you what I'm doing. I want to see if you see the same thing I see. Smart business people recognize it. Smart business people make their own decisions. So where are we today as I wrap up this part one? See, I laugh at the reviews when I've got some idiot millennial who was 6 years old or 10 years old when I introduced Q codes, who pick up on one stupid little thing, stupidest invention ever. That's why you see codes everywhere, right? It was so damn stupid. Never work, laughed at technology, whatever. They don't do their homework. And all they do is take the lowest hanging fruit is repeating idiocy. But I laugh at that. I laugh at it because they actually spin the story that I got all these investors, took all their money and did all this stuff. Do you think you could walk into the door of a major corporation like Belo, Coca-Cola, Hearst, NBC, say, give me a check for $30 million. They go, oh, mesmerizing you. Here you go. That's not how it works. We were the most due diligence, most legally looked at, most torn apart deal in the world. And all of those top corporations made decisions because they knew I was right. They decided to do it with me because I have impeccable credentials, because I can deliver and do it. So don't ever be fooled by the crap you read because it could scare you. I know you're thinking about getting your company funded. There's always fear of it not working. And you're worried how the press will eat your lunch. Well, remember this. They're just the press. They work for somebody. They get a paycheck. They don't have the balls it takes to create a company from the ground up. So why would a lion even worry about what the sheep will think? Stay true to your dream. be courageous. And if it's a good product and a good idea, it will sell yourself. Your only job is to share the vision. And if it's good, and if it's rock solid, it will sell itself. In our next installment, we're going to talk about the book. You've been listening to The Beginning, which is the big idea.